Thank you very much for your warm welcome this week. It's been great to be back with you. So thank you very much for that. Do keep that passage open. I want to begin with reading part of a letter that was written by 13-year-old Millie Dowler. It was found in her bedroom following her death. And this is what it said. "Dear Daddy and my beautiful Mummy, by the time you find this letter, I'll be gone, up there or down below you. I've always been that way, below other people. I'm sorry, you deserve a better daughter, so I've left. If anything, you should be happy now that you can concentrate on lovely Gemsy, so sister, without me getting in the way. I think it'd be best if you try and forget me. It's nothing that you have done. I just feel I had to go. Please don't let any harm get to any of you. Mum and Dad, please look after Gemma. I'm sorry, but goodbye. Lots of love, as always, your little disappointment, Amanda." And in a poem, she said about herself that, "I know I'm pathetic and helpless, and I know I'm not pretty or fit," whereas she saw her sister as pretty, smart, intelligent, wanted, and loved. And it's a desperately sad case, but what makes it all the more poignant is that, of course, many people can relate to what she felt. I mean, do you ever feel that you yourself are a disappointment? That others are so much better than you? Maybe smarter, maybe better looking, more successful. Some may feel that they're a disappointment to their parents, to their spouse, to their friends. And some may feel that they are a disappointment to God. If you were to write a letter to God, perhaps you would sign it, "Your little disappointment." Because when you look at your life as a Christian, you feel such a failure. You look at other people, and they seem to be so much more godly than you are, and more committed, and impressive, and successful, and sorted, and strong, and you feel so weak. If that is you, then the passage today is a door of hope. Because it's all about weakness and how God uses that. That our weakness, which we try to cover up, is actually an asset, not a liability from God's perspective. So God says in chapter 12, verse 9, "My power is made perfect in weakness." And that is the theme, not just of this section, but of the whole letter. And so Paul affirms in chapter 12, verse 10, "When I am weak, then I am strong." But that is something he had to learn, and it's something that we need to learn too, because it is not how we naturally think. So we're going to look at how this biblical principle is worked out in three areas: Christian leadership, ministry, and experience. And incidentally, if you're someone who cannot relate at all to what I've just been saying so far, so if you tend rather to think that God's actually a lucky fellow to have you on his side, and that your birth was a turning point in church history, don't tune out. This passage is relevant to you as well. So firstly then, power in weakness in Christian leadership. Verse 16, Paul says, "I repeat, let no one think me foolish, but even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little." So Paul begins by saying, "Let no one think me foolish," because that is precisely what the false apostles were saying about him. So these false teachers who had come to Corinth, they dismissed the apostle Paul as being an unimpressive fool. They boasted about themselves, they were dismissive of Paul. And so Paul responds with some boasting of his own to show how foolish they were, and we'll come to that in a minute. But the believers in Corinth were the real fools for putting up with these false teachers, these false apostles. So just look at how these leaders were treating them in verse 20. Verse 20 he says, "For you bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face." Now, they accepted being treated like this, presumably because they thought this was a strong, good leadership. But that is not God's way. Paul listed in that verse there, verse 20, five hallmarks of these worldly leaders. And it's what you still find in cults and, in fact, many churches today. Number one is enslaving them. So they enslave by being domineering in their leadership style and by being legalistic in their teaching. Number two there, exploiting them. So where he says devours you. So they were exploiting believers financially. They were after their money. And perhaps one of the saddest parts of the Harold Camping predictions that the world would end the other month was the financial exploitation. So Christians selling their homes and sending their money to his organization. Number three, taking advantage of them. So exercising complete control over them. Number four, putting on airs. Literally lifting themselves up so they were promoting themselves. A ministry built around the personality of the leader. And number five, striking them in the face. So being abusive and harsh. So exploitative, manipulative, harsh, domineering, self-promoting. It seems tough. It's sort of ruling with a rod of iron. And many people like it, but it is not God's design for leadership. One aspect of this is what's called heavy shepherding. So this is where a leader sets himself up as being the authority and demands total submission to him. And so the leader makes decisions about everything in the lives of the believer. So what job they do, where they live, who they marry, what they do in their spare time. The leader becomes God. And no one is allowed to question them. And clearly some find it very appealing. Perhaps they find it liberating to just abdicate responsibility and to let another person run their life for them. But it is not God's way. Paul said back in chapter 10, verse 1, I entreat you by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ. Christ, of course, was the ultimate leader, and he was meek and he was gentle. Do you remember Matthew 12, 20? God said, Behold my servant whom I've chosen, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not quench. And that was Peter's template for leadership as well. Meek and gentle. So as Peter says in 1 Peter 5:2, he's speaking to church elders. Shepherd the flock of God, not for shameful gain, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. So not heavy shepherding, but gentle shepherding. Now such leadership draws lines. It is committed to teaching the truth and exposing error. It exercises discipline where necessary, but it is meek and gentle and leading by example and being open about your own struggles and sin. And it may seem weak and it may seem unimpressive compared with the authoritarian, domineering, controlling leadership of false apostles, but it is through such weak leadership that God works in power. Now, many of us here exercise leadership at different levels, in the church family, in the home, at work. All of us exercise leadership in the sense that we influence other people. Now, do you ever look at other people and think, you know, if only I were like him or her? You know, if only I had that big personality, their charisma, their dynamism. God's power is made perfect in weakness. So don't try to be someone you're not. Be yourself and be like Christ. Be yourself and be like Christ. There was a Puritan guy called John Flavel who wrote this. He said, How the weak have been used for the good of the church. Christ did not choose eloquent orators or men of authority in the courts of kings and emperors, but 12 poor laborers and fishermen. This is the most ridiculous course that can be imagined in appearance for such a design. And yet in how short a time was the gospel spread in all the kingdoms of the world. Leadership God's way is about God using weak people who are using weak means. God's power is made perfect in weakness. Secondly, power in weakness in Christian ministry. The false apostles were boasting about themselves, their abilities, their achievements. And here Paul sort of plays them at their own childish game, and he does some boasting of his own. But you'll see there's a bit of a twist. So verse 21, he says, "But whatever anyone else dares to boast of, I'm speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast of that." And what he then goes on to give in verses 22 to 33 is a review of his own ministry, but with a difference. So what he boasts of are things that show how weak he is, not how impressive he is. And verse 30 sums up what he's doing here. So verse 30 says, "If I must boast, I'll boast of the things that show my weakness." Now, although what he describes here may seem quite remote from our experience in practice, the principle for Christian service remains the same. This is a biblical pattern for ministry: strength in weakness. So you'll see Paul's ministry involved physical hardships. So verses 23 to 27. Verse 23 gives a summary. Verse 23 says, "Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one." I'm talking like a madman. "With far greater labours, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings and often near death." And then in verses 24 and 25, he gives some statistics. Now, the Roman greats would use statistics in the records of their achievements. So to give you an example, the Emperor Augustus declared, "Twice I received triumphal ovations, 3 times I received triumphs, 20 times and one did I receive the appellation of imperator," whatever that means. And here Paul lists his own statistics, verses 24 and 25. "Flogged by the Jews 5 times, by the Romans 3 times, once stoned, 3 times shipwrecked." He lists 7 dangers he faced in his missionary travels. And in verse 27, his tent-making labours. So hard menial work through the night so he could do mission work during the day. In addition, in verses 28 and 29, there was the psychological pressure, what he calls the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. So he had the anxiety of a pastor for the churches, a bit like a parent for their children. And then lastly, he relates this incident of personal indignity in verses 30 to 32. So verse 32, he says, "At Damascus, the governor under King Aretas was guarding the city of Damascus in order to seize me, but I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped his hands." One of the greatest honours for a Roman soldier was what was called the Corona Muralis. And basically, this was an award that was given to the first soldier to go over the wall when they were besieging a city. Paul is saying he was the first over the wall, but in the opposite direction. Yeah, he wasn't conquering the city, he was fleeing from it, fleeing for his life, running away. He's lowered down in a basket, probably a fish basket. I mean, how undignified can you get? The false apostles, they boasted of their achievements, and they would have found Paul's catalogue here of failure and weakness deeply embarrassing. But Paul knew that God's power is made perfect in weakness. And so he wasn't ashamed. Rather than undermining his ministry, this catalogue of weakness, it validated his ministry. Here was a true apostle following in the footsteps of Christ, the suffering servant. Here is someone whose New Testament writings we can trust. But here also is a pattern of gospel ministry which has been lived out down the ages since. John Wycliffe, who translated the first Bible into English, he trained up and he sent out preachers to teach the people. And it was a sort of 14th century Cornhill training course. And these guys were called Lollards. They went out on the road with coarse clothing and with no money. And all of them were martyred. They were burned to the stake, and they had their Bibles hung around their necks as they burned. In so many countries today, Christian ministry is a carbon copy of Paul's here, in the detail as well as in the principle. Rejection, opposition, danger, death. And from a worldly perspective, it seems a failure. People enduring terrible hardship and suffering for the sake of a message which is largely rejected. But God's power is made perfect in weakness. This is how God works. Open Doors has got an appeal they're running called Secret Children, which is to support children around the world who are suffering because they follow Jesus. Here's one example. Daniel's father was a pastor. He'd been warned many times by the local guerrillas not to preach the gospel, but he had steadfastly shared the good news of Jesus. So one day they fired 6 shots into Pastor Miguel from close range. Daniel and his sister watched their father die in front of them. The trauma for the 9-year-old boy was extreme, but so were his courage and his faith. When his father died, Daniel took his father's belt and his watch and he put them on. "My daddy says we should continue preaching," he said. "He's in heaven and we need to continue." There have been dark days for the family left behind. Daniel, his mother and his sister Ingrid were forced to flee the area. Money has been scarce. Daniel and Ingrid have struggled to adjust to a new school. But they still have their faith, and Daniel still has some of his father's clothes. And one day, he says, he'll wear them and be a preacher, just like his father. But what about us? I mean, it all seems very remote, doesn't it, from our own experience. I mean, ministry in Western culture is by and large pretty comfortable. So whether you're a church minister or whether you're any Christian serving the Lord. I mean, how do we relate to a passage like this? Well, we cannot help the fact that we happen to live in a country and at a time where followers of Jesus have an easier ride. We can't help that. And it's not as if we're to seek suffering, we're just to be faithful. But what we need to beware is the opposite. And the opposite is the success syndrome. You see, the false apostles had a worldly value system. Ministry for them was all about success and achievement, which were highly valued in that culture. And that worldly value system is a big temptation for us. Where is God at work in power in the world today? Where is God at work in power in the world today? So, for example, in which churches is God at work in power? If we just use worldly criteria, we'd look at what sort of things? We'd look at size, we'd look at growth rate, we'd look at bank balance. But God does not assess churches like football clubs. So it's not like the successful clubs are the top four in the Premiership. They've got the biggest bank balances, they've got the biggest stadiums, they've got the most supporters, you know, they can buy the best players and they get the top results. Now, if we see things like that, we'll miss what God is doing. We'll make wrong judgments about where God is at work. Big and fast growing does not mean God is at work. Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, he may be at work there, as he clearly is at St. Helens and has been over the years, but it doesn't necessarily follow. And small does not mean abandoned by God. In fact, all around the world, God is powerfully at work in unimpressive, small, faithful churches, maybe just 30 or so very ordinary people, weak but faithful, and God is at work in power. In which church ministers is God at work in power? Again, if we just use worldly values and criteria, we would pick out who? Well, a minister who's got a reputation, who's a well-known author, who's in demand as a conference speaker. And that's what so many young guys in ministry aspire to. But those, again, are worldly criteria of success. The leader nobody has heard about, who never gets published, who preaches every week to 30 people, and who dies in obscurity, he may be a faithful minister, through whom God is at work in power. just as much, if not more, than the other person. I was at a recent conference, and one of the speakers who was on the platform leads a church which has grown from a few people in his living room to 10,000 people. He's founded an organization which has planted 400 churches. He's the most downloaded preacher on the planet. Another man was interviewed for just a few minutes during this conference, who worked with the Navigators in Nigeria, and many of you know him. He limped onto the stage. Half of his face is missing, where he was shot in the face by armed robbers when he was serving in Nigeria. His wife was abused during the same raid. But they keep going back to Nigeria, he was saying, because they have Christ's love for the people there. Which man is God working through in power? God's value system is not the same as the world's. And quite how different God's value system is will only really be seen on the last day, when we're told the first will be last and the last will be first. And I suspect some of the surprises on that day will be a lot bigger than we could possibly imagine. Now, this was a lesson that Kent Hughes learned the hard way. In his book, it's on the bookstall, Liberating Ministry from the Success Syndrome, he shares his own experience of depression and burnout. He had basically been taught that God's blessing meant visible success of church growth. Growth in numbers, in giving, in staff, in programs. And his church wasn't growing. And he felt a failure. And he knew he wasn't alone. This is what he wrote. Most people I know in the ministry are unhappy. They're failures in their own eyes. Every year, thousands leave the ministry convinced they are failures. But his concern in writing the book is not just for church ministers like myself, but for all Christians in all types of service. So he went on to write this. We are concerned about the morale and the survival of those in Christian ministry. Pastors, youth workers, evangelists, Sunday school teachers, lay ministers, missionaries, Bible study leaders, Christian writers and speakers, and those in other areas of Christian service often face significant feelings of failure, usually fueled by misguided expectations of success. And his book is basically a call to be faithful, not to be successful. Do you feel a failure in your service of the Lord? Maybe in your service at church, maybe in your witness in the workplace. Do you compare yourself with other people? Beware the success syndrome. God's power is made perfect in weakness. Be faithful. And if we do enjoy success, in inverted commas, in worldly terms, we need to beware self-promotion. You see, no doubt Paul could have written here a very different report. Yeah, if he'd wanted, he could have boasted about all his achievements. He could have said, 15 churches planted, 500 people converted, 23 people healed, and so on. And there is a time and a place for reporting what God has done through us. So in Acts 14:27, Paul reports back to his sending church what God had done through him on his missionary journey. But that is a long, long way from self-promotion. Self-promotion is the best way to ensure that God will not be at work through you in power. Self-promotion, it is the best way to ensure that God will not work through you in power because God will not share his glory. There's one young missionary who recalls having found himself on board ship with Billy Graham as a young man. So young Billy Graham was on his way to London to a crusade. And the missionary observed that Graham very rarely spoke about himself or his phenomenal experiences as an evangelist. And at the end of their voyage, the missionary asked the young evangelist how he could pray for him. And the answer Billy Graham gave was, "Pray that I will be a humble man." And by all accounts, that prayer seems to have been answered. If you are proud of your abilities and your service and full of yourself, you may find God humbles you so that he can really use you. The final area where we see this principle of power and weakness being worked out is in Christian experience. Reading between the lines here, it seems that these false apostles boasted about the visions and the revelations that they'd had, or at least claimed to have had, and that this was a focus in their ministry. And they dismissed the apostle Paul because in his preaching, these sort of things didn't feature. Now, in response, in chapter 12, verses 1 to 6, Paul affirms, he affirms that he has had these sort of spiritual experiences. So in verse 1, these visions and revelations of the Lord. And he recounts how 14 years previously he'd been caught up into paradise in an ecstatic experience. But such an experience was a private thing. Yeah? It was just between him and God. It wasn't for bragging about. And even here, you notice he speaks about it with great reluctance. So in verse 2, he says, I know a man in Christ who... So he speaks about it with great reluctance in the third person, and only because they forced him to it. Basically, he wanted people to judge him on the basis of him as a person, not because of some spiritual experiences he'd had. As he says in verse 6, that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. So whatever spiritual experiences you have had is between you and the Lord. It's not for sharing with others to make yourself seem superior. And we should beware those. We should beware those who talk about visions and ecstatic experiences as if that validates them as being authentic. I don't know if you've come across one popular speaker on certain circuits is called the Jellyfish Man. Basically, he packs out churches and he tells his story of how he was stung by deadly jellyfish, and he was taken up into heaven, and he describes what was revealed to him there. It's gripping stuff. Such experiences, if real, are not the stuff of everyday life, everyday Christian life. And in fact, Paul recounts how, having been lifted high in his vision, he was rapidly brought back down to earth with a bump. So verse 7, he says, So to keep me from becoming conceited, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me, i.e. given by God, in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Now the word translated thorn there, it could be one of two things. It could be a stake, so you know, a big thing pinning him to the earth. Or it could be a thorn, like a sort of splinter, a constant source of pain. Notice it was both given to him by God to humble him, and also was a messenger of Satan to harass him. Now you may be thinking, how could both be true? Well, we actually see how both could be true in the book of Job. Were Job's sufferings from God or from the devil? Well, it's both. The devil afflicts Job and his household, but only by God's sovereign permission. Now, whatever it was very painful, and Paul pleaded with God to take it away, but God didn't, because it is through our weakness that God works in power. So verse 8, he says, three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Have you ever said to God, why have you allowed this to happen to me? You know, why this difficulty? Have you ever prayed for God to remove the difficulty and wondered why he hasn't? Well, the answer's here, that God's power is made perfect in our weakness. For God to work through his in power, we need to be weak, not strong. We need to be dependent, not self-sufficient. We need to be grounded, not sort of floating away with a sense of our own importance. And so God allows all sorts of difficulties in our lives. Now, Paul doesn't tell us here what his thorn in the flesh was, and maybe he didn't tell us so that we wouldn't limit its application. And it may have come in one of the categories I've listed. So your thorn could be physical, It could be a chronic illness, could be a disability, a condition. It could be infertility. Could be just something about your body that you wish was different. Your thorn could be mental. You may suffer from depression. Or you may just be frustrated that you're not as sharp as other people. Your thorn could be moral. It could be a particular area in which you feel temptation really strongly and you feel especially weak. Your thorn could be relational. So it could be a difficult relationship at work or at home, which is an ongoing source of pain and irritation. Or it could be someone missing who you want to be in your life. So you may be struggling with bereavement or with singleness. Why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't he answer my prayers? I thought God was supposed to love me. Why does he allow this? Why doesn't he heal me? Why not remove this difficulty or this person which is causing me such grief? I feel so weak. I feel such a failure. I could get so much more done. You know, I'd be so much more useful to God without this. But you know, you actually wouldn't be. You wouldn't be. Because our weakness is essential to God's strategy. Now, God may sort things out, but equally, he may say to you, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. I guess one question that comes up is, you know, at what point do you stop praying for God to remove the problem and instead pray for God to give you his grace to cope? At what point do you do that? You see, Paul knew, didn't he, when that point came, because the Lord spoke to him. But for the rest of us, I guess it's not so cut and dried. I mean, just examples I've talked about before. I've mentioned my wife Lena and the fact she's had these chronic migraines since she was about 3 years old. And most days she has a bad head to some degree. Do we still pray for God to heal her? Sometimes, but more often we pray for his grace to be sufficient. Mentioned Sebastian, you know, before he was born, we prayed for God to heal him of his disability. Since his birth, we've accepted this is God's will, and we pray instead for God's power to be made perfect in his weakness and in ours. And for all of us here, there'll be lots and lots of things in our lives which regularly bring us to our knees in weakness and crying out to God. And that is how we experience God's power. So God's power does not just deliver us out of difficulties, but it keeps us going and faithfully serving in difficulties. So verse 9, Paul says, therefore, I'll boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Christ in his power, literally translated there, he pitches his tent with his people in their weakness. It's a beautiful image. He pitches his tent with his people in their weakness, because it is when we're weak that we depend on him. Someone has written this: weakness is not a matter of shame, but both a fact of life and a divine strategy. Weakness is the field in which God operates. It is then an essential characteristic of Christian living and Christian ministry. And we could add, it's an essential first step in coming to know God at all. And so if you're not a Christian, God does not want you to bring to him all your successes and your achievements. He wants you to humbly acknowledge your failure, morally, spiritually, and your need of him. Martin Luther wrote, "It is certain that man must utterly despair of his own ability before he is prepared to receive the grace of Christ." And if you feel that despair, and if you feel that sense of failure today before God, if you feel that, then you're standing before a door of hope. Let's take a moment of quiet to respond in prayer, and then Mark will lead us.